It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Susan LaFleche was born in 1865, born into a time, place, and culture where the prospects for a Native American child, let alone a girl, were not very good. But Susan LaFleche was an extraordinary woman and part of an extraordinary family. In 1889, she would become the first Native American doctor, male or female, in U.S. history. Joe Sterita has written about the life and legacy of this woman in his new book, A Warrior of the People. He'll be speaking in Ames on Monday, April 10th at 7 p.m. in Dolezal Auditorium in Curtis Hall on the campus of Iowa State University. The lecture is open to the public, and he is with me now. Hello, Joe. Joe, can you hear me?
Hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for being here today.
Hello.
I don't think Joe can hear me, unfortunately.
Oh, for God's sake.
Okay. We will connect with Joe in a different way. This hour, we're going to be talking about the life of Susan LaFleche. She was the first Native American doctor, male or female, in U.S. history. And again, she became a doctor at the unlikely time of 1889. And then she returned to Nebraska to serve her people, the Omaha people. Let's see if Joe can hear me now. Joe, can you hear me now, Joe?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. What a tremendous improvement. All right.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Good.
Joe, thank you so much for being here today. And I would like to know how you first became aware of Dr. Susan LaFleche.
I became aware of Dr. Susan LaFleche because a number of years ago, I burrowed into 3 years of research on a courageous Ponca chief by the name of Standing Bear, who on May 2nd, 1879, in a federal courtroom in Omaha, became the center of a landmark civil rights decision in which a federal judge determined for the first time in the 103-year history of the United States that Indian people from that point on were to be regarded as persons within the meaning of the law, entitled to the same constitutional privileges as, quote, the more fortunate white race. So in the course of doing the research to get that story out, it came to pass that a woman by the name of Suzette LaFleche, also known as Bright Eyes, was Standing Bear's official interpreter. So Suzette LaFleche, a.k.a. Bright Eyes, introduced me to the LaFleche family, which I think I could make a credible argument is perhaps the most interesting American Indian family in history. Bright Eyes was the first American Indian male or female to publicly stump up and down the East Coast week after week, year after year, promoting citizenship rights for American Indians. Her younger sister, Susan, was the first American Indian doctor, male or female, and their half-brother, Francis, was the first American Indian ethnographer. So it's a remarkable family, and I eventually got led to Susan because I was doing research on a previous book, and her older sister, who was a beacon and a shining light and a terrific role model for the youngest of the four daughters, was Standing Bear's interpreter. So when I found out about Bright Eyes, the oldest sister, I found out about Susan, the youngest sister.
So let's talk a little bit more about this remarkable family. And I think to understand these sisters and the brother and the remarkable things that they did, we need to talk about their father, Joseph LaFleche. Tell me about him.
Well, you cannot understand Susan or Francis or Bright Eyes. You cannot understand any of those children unless you understand Joseph LaFleche. Joseph LaFleche was the last recognized chief of the Omaha, who hundreds of years ago came from their ancestral home, ran around the Great Lakes, and they settled in northwest Iowa and northeast Nebraska. Joseph, like every other chief of the 1870s, had a fork in the road. He could turn right with an assimilationist vision, or he could turn left and stick to tribal tradition. It was a difficult decision for every chief. The chief's ultimate responsibility was the welfare of his people. So Joseph believed that the only way his people could survive, like every other animal, every other plant on the Great Plains, if you did not adapt, you would perish. So he opted to assimilate, to incorporate what he thought were the best of white values into the Omaha cultural tradition and try and pull off a twofer. And it was a very difficult challenge. Half of the tribe hated him, wanted nothing to do with him, but he passionately believed in every DNA in his body that education was the key to the castle.
Well, and you say assimilate, although he did try to create this kind of hybrid culture where,
right,
as you said, he would adopt the best of what he saw as white culture and keep the traditions alive as well. But education was really the key for him.
Education was the glue that held his vision together. Without education, he saw no way that his beloved four daughters and son could ever succeed because a new dominant order had replaced tribal tradition, and there was nothing they could do about that. The United States government habitually would invite the chiefs of the tribes to Washington, D.C., knowing that when they got off the train and looked out, they would see more white people than they'd ever imagined existed. They would see streets filled with trolley cars and bustling with commerce, schools, churches laid out in a perfect grid, and the visual impact of that was so overwhelming that all of these chiefs would return back to the Great Plains almost literally in a state of shock. And this happened to Joseph LaFleche. And when he got back to his people, he told them, I have seen the future, and the future is we have to assimilate or we will cease to exist. And as your chief, I am going to promote that, and I'm going to start with my own family. And those children were not allowed, even though they were fluent in Omaha, they were not allowed to speak anything but English in the home. He wanted to do everything he could to position them to adopt the white values, but not shed any of their Omaha identity, and therefore position them to be leaders of the Omaha people heading into the opening years of the 20th century. That was his vision. It was a very contentious one because there were diehard traditionalists who wanted to cling to the Omaha way of life and have nothing to do with the New World Order. But Joseph saw nothing but disaster if you embraced that view.
I find it very interesting that he decided to start with his own children, his own family, but not necessarily with himself. I mean, he was a very intelligent man, clearly. He knew a great deal about a number of different tribes, and he had studied different cultures, but he didn't speak English, and he wasn't literate.
No, he was neither of those, but he was smart enough to realize that those two things that he did not possess were two critical things that all of his children had to possess. You know, his day, in some ways, the ship had sailed. But not for his children. The world that he grew up in was going to be a much different world than the one they grew up in. And he could survive when he was in his 20s and 30s by adhering to traditional Omaha beliefs. When his children got in their 20s and 30s, they could never survive or ever succeed or ever really have a life if they weren't willing to incorporate the best of American culture and try and wed it to the best of Omaha Indian culture. And in the end, I could make a pretty intelligent argument, I think, that Susan's greatest triumph in the end was to thread this delicate bicultural needle and pull off being able to balance that without ever losing her native soul. And that was perhaps her greatest triumph, that she could thread a very elusive bicultural needle without ever losing her Omaha Indian soul.
Now, if you spend any time looking into the history of the mistreatment of Native American tribes in the United States, and there was so much mistreatment, and you spend time learning about the schools that Native American children attended.
Sure.
I mean, there was a lot of abuse. This was a really ugly educational system. How was it for the LaFleche children? Where did they get their education?
Well, the LaFleche children, Joseph, one very powerful personality trait that he had was he was curious. He was very curious about the world around him, and he was willing to experiment and take chances if he thought it would benefit his family and his people. And one of the things that he was intensely curious about was Christianity. He had missionaries from the Omaha Reservation read him parts of the Bible, and then he would dwell and think about those for two or three days on end, and then he would schedule a meeting with a missionary, and they would talk the entire day about a certain parable, about a certain verse, about something that had really gained his curiosity. So he forged a relationship with the missionaries on the Omaha Reservation at an very early age, and those missionaries had very strong ties to the whole educational infrastructure on the East Coast. So he was able, by developing friendships with the missionaries who were on the Omaha Reservation, he was able to parlay that into getting his children, all of his children, with the exception of one daughter, into East Coast schools. For example, the woman we're talking about, Susan LaFleche, the first American Indian doctor in our history, at age 14, she boarded a train and she went 1,500 miles east to Elizabeth, New Jersey, where she spent the next 2 years enrolled in a private all-girls school in Elizabeth, New Jersey, that came about because of her father's connection with the missionary on the Omaha tribe in northeast Nebraska. And that was the beginning, the lead domino in an educational system that really shaped Susan's life. But it was because of Joseph's curiosity and kind of fascination with this new kind of religion that developed a friendship that led to the connection that got his youngest daughter on her way by being incubated in a private girls' school where she took advanced classes, and she got off to a very strong start in terms of fulfilling Joseph's dream that education was the key to the castle.
But it also meant that these girls had to leave the homeland of their people.
That's
and
right.
Spend many years away from home. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about the remarkable life of Dr. Susan LaFleche. She was the very first Native American doctor in U.S. history, male or female. And Joe Sterotta has written about her in his new book, A Warrior of the People. He'll be speaking in Ames on Monday, April 10th at 7 p.m. in Dolezal Auditorium in Curtis Hall on the campus of Iowa State University. The lecture is open to the public. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm talking with Joe Sterotta. His latest book is called A Warrior of the People, How Susan LaFleche Overcame Racial and Gender Inequality to Become America's First Indian Doctor. We're talking about this remarkable woman and her story this hour, and Joe Sterotta will be at Iowa State University coming up on April 10th. He'll be speaking in Curtis Hall at 7 p.m. on Monday, the 10th. The lecture is open to the public. And Joe, just before the break, we were talking about how these little Omaha girls managed to get an education at a time when getting an education was extremely difficult on an Indian reservation. It was extremely difficult for girls, period, in the
right.
country at that time. So,
right.
Tell me a little bit more about the schools that these girls were sent to, because they were sent off to the East Coast.
Yeah, well, Susan, as we were saying before the break, the father had an ironclad vision that his beloved daughters and son could only succeed in the New World Order if they had an education. He befriended Christian missionaries on the Omaha Reservation. They had connections to schools on the East Coast. And so for Susan, who we're talking about, she's 14 years old. She's on a train. She's going 1,500 miles away to a place called Elizabeth, New Jersey, far, far removed from her beloved family and her beloved homeland and her beloved tribe. So she just had to suck it up, and she gets to Elizabeth, and she spends 2 years there, and she lays the educational foundation that's going to pay off in spades over the course of the next 6 or 7 years. Then she comes back, and in another 6 months, she has, through the same – now she has acquired a group of powerful white women who have been introduced to her in somewhat serendipitous fashion. But these women, Alice Fletcher, attached to the Peabody Museum at Harvard, the first female ethnologist in American history. She comes in contact with this teenage daughter of the Omaha chief, and she cannot believe how mature Susan is, how focused she is, how disciplined she is, how smart she is. And she starts telling some of her powerful white women friends about this remarkable Omaha Indian girl out in the middle of the Great Plains, and they begin to form this flying wedge around her. They are going to bulldoze and knock down every roadblock they have that is set up because of her gender and her race. And the next thing that happens is they get the 16-year-old Susan into what is now Hampton University in Hampton, Virginia. And that's a whole other story into itself. It's this educational experiment in which they are taking the sons and daughters of American chiefs and blending them into a university with the sons and daughters of recently freed slaves, trying to integrate both the Native people and the African American people into becoming white citizens. And it's a
Although they weren't mixing them with white students. This was fully segregated.
No, it was almost exclusively African Americans and Native Americans that were in this agricultural-based school in Hampton, Virginia, that was taught by white instructors.
Now,
but the point was to find an educational mechanism that would take the sons and daughters of recently freed slaves and put them in classes with Native American offspring of the chiefs and other powerful members like Susan LaFlesh was, and have them come out with a profession, with a skill, with a trade, with an avocation, primarily teaching. And this is the next stop on Susan's journey. Booker T. Washington is the most famous graduate of Hampton, and it's a remarkable story how he got in. So there are remarkable photographs showing these classrooms. And the African-American students were so motivated because their parents could neither read nor write, and they knew that they had to make the best of these years at Hampton, and the Native children were often the same way. So it was this really unique educational experiment, and after 2 years at Elizabeth, New Jersey, Susan resurfaces. She graduates second in her class at Hampton. She continues to inspire all of these powerful women, white women around her, who keep seeing more and more potential, and so they keep knocking over these obstacles, and by they finally get her in the 1880s into the one medical school in the world that accepts women in the 1880s and trains them as doctors.
And I would love for you to read just a little bit to help us put this in even starker context, because, I mean, not only is this a Native American woman seeking to become a doctor, even being a woman seeking to become a doctor at that time, the odds were so overwhelmingly against you.
Right, exactly. And that, what you've just said is so important, because you cannot begin to grasp or understand the magnitude of Susan's achievement unless you understand the current that she was swimming against. And almost as an inside play on words, the word Omaha in the Omaha language, the literal translation of Omaha is against the current or upstream. And that's what Susan was doing. The last quarter of the 19th century, the height of the Victorian era, was completely top-down, dominated by a white male culture that set the bar for white women about a quarter of an inch off the ground. So you can imagine in 1870s and 80s where it was set for an Indian woman. And these people who were promoting some of these scientific philosophies were not the ideological knuckle-draggers with just one foot out of the cave. These were the Stephen Hawkings of the era. So if I may read a section, one paragraph out of one of the scientific journals of the era, you will get an understanding of how much of the current was forcing Susan to swim harder and harder every day. This is a direct quote. "Just therefore, as higher civilization is heralded, or at least evidenced by increasing bulk of brain, just as the most intelligent and the dominant races surpass their rivals in cranial capacity, and just as in those races the leaders, where in the sphere of thought or of action, are eminently large-brained, so we must naturally expect that man, surpassing woman in volume of brain, must surpass her in at least a proportionate degree in intellectual power. And that was a proclamation that could be found in the December 1878 issue of Popular Science Monthly. Not to be outdone, the Journal of the Anthropological Society of London went one step farther, and I quote, "During menstruation, women suffer under a languor and depression which disqualify them from thought or action, and render it extremely doubtful how far they can be considered responsible human beings while the crisis lasts. In intellectual labor, man has surpassed, does now, and always will surpass woman, for the obvious reason that nature does not periodically interrupt his thought and application." So that gives you a pretty good framework to understand. If you're a woman in the 1880s and you want to not only become educated, but you want to become a doctor, the magnitude of the hurdles that you had to clear were impressive, to say the least.
And again, at the same time, she is a Native American woman.
Exactly.
And,
right.
You know, so many people, in spite of Chief Standing Bear, or maybe this was about the same time as Chief Standing Bear, most people didn't consider Native Americans to be people.
Right, exactly. And, it's kind of a nice little quirk of fate that Standing Bear, his seminal trial in Omaha occurred in 1879 when a federal judge declared that, as shocking as it may seem now, that Indians had to be regarded as people. And that same year that federal decision was made was the same year that 14-year-old Susan boarded a train in Omaha, where the trial was occurring, and was headed to Elizabeth, New Jersey, to begin her initial 2 years in a private school that would eventually pay off by getting her into medical school.
Now, why did she want to become a doctor?
She wanted to become a doctor. When I teach a narrative nonfiction class here at the University of Nebraska, one of the issues when we're doing profiles is you must ask every person you are profiling if there was a specific incident in their life that altered the trajectory of their life. Was there a St. Paul on the road to Damascus moment in that person's life? So if you were interviewing Susan right now and you asked her that question, the answer would be yes. And she would say, "I was 8 years old. I was on the Omaha reservation. There was an elderly woman in the room with me, and she was dying a horrible, agonizing death. We sent for the white doctor once, twice, three times, four times, and he never came. And by morning, it was just me and the elderly Omaha woman. And I sat there, and as the sun came up, I watched her die this horrible, painful, agonizing death. And I decided at that moment that I would do everything humanly possible to become a doctor and to spend the rest of my life taking care of my Omaha Indian people." And that's exactly what happened.
So she goes to medical school, and even at that time, there was some controversy about whether or not the female students would be allowed to watch autopsies. They did gain that right. Did she thrive in medical school right away? Was this,
Yes. She was an academic star from the beginning, and that's because if you just wind back to the headwaters lead you to Joseph LaFleche and the values that he established in his home, the goals that he established for his children. And then Susan goes off to Elizabeth, so she's used to 14 to 16 being away from home. It's not fun. It's not happy. It's not joyful, but she sucks it up and she gets through and she lays the foundation. And then she builds on that foundation at Hampton. So by the time that she gets to medical school, She is fluent in five languages. She has been away from home. She is excited about absorbing all of these new prompts, these new cultural prompts from her white classmates, whose parents are fascinated with this Omaha Indian girl. They take her to concerts. They take her to poetry readings. She's sitting at tables that have silver forks and silver spoons and china plates and things she's never seen before. And she writes these she's so homesick and so overwhelmed and stimulated that she writes 10, 12 letters a week. She fills up every single line. She curls around on the margins and takes up every spare inch of paper to convey her excitement and her homesickness in letter after letter after letter. So if you're a writer and you're trying to tell this story from the inside out, if you're trying to get the reader inside Susan's head and seeing what she's seeing when she's in New Jersey and when she's at Hampton and now at the Woman's Medical College of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, it's just a treasure trove that shows the reader how this woman was feeling and thinking at the time. And for many American Indians, this is a very tricky intersection. You are not supposed to poke around and cut open the bodies of people, the bodies of dead people. There are all kinds of cultural taboos against this. So this is another crossroads. This is another intersection where the past confronts the present. And Susan, because of the incident she witnessed as an 8-year-old, because of all the illness and sickness she sees every time she goes home, she is more and more determined to be a doctor and not entrust the welfare of her people to anybody other than someone who can also speak their language. And so that helps her cross the divide and surmount the cultural taboo of cutting open a body. And she crosses that, and she learns to love her anatomy classes and the autopsies because she just is very science oriented, and she sees this as a means to an end, now, which is to help her people.
She was supported by these white women you were talking about, and it's pretty clear that they considered her to be a wonderful novelty. You know, they wanted to show her the culture and take her around, but she also was writing these letters of loneliness and homesickness.
Right.
Did she have friends? Was she able to connect with people as a human, or was she treated mostly as a novelty item by these people?
A little of both. She became very close friends with some of her classmates. And they were intrigued by what she brought to the table that was totally missing from their world, and she was intrigued by their upbringing on the East Coast and what they brought to the table that was not a part of the Omaha reservation world. So with several of the students, she became very close friends, and she identifies them by name in her letters, and she talks about, oh, Sarah and I went for a long walk at a major park in Philadelphia. There was a light snow going. We had such fun and reminded us of being home. And then we went back to her house and she made fresh brownies and I started playing the guitar and we started singing. So there are those kind of intimate, nice moments. And also she in many ways was kind of a poster child for some of the Christian organizations on the East Coast that had adopted her. And ultimately, the Connecticut Indian Association agreed to pay for all of Susan's medical school on the condition that she not fall in love or that she not marry for at least 2 years after she graduates. And that's one of the things I love about this story. We all know about the American West. Who doesn't know about the American West? People in the backwaters of New Zealand know about the American West. It's become this mythic landscape over time, starting with dime store novels in the 1860s and 70s, and then going with Buffalo Bill Cody in the 1880s, and then going with early Hollywood pictures, and now Hollywood has kept that ball rolling, so everybody knows about the American West. But what we know about the American West, when we walk up those steps and we look out the window on this panoramic sweep of this iconic thing called the American West, that view that we see has always been shaped by men. We know about the American West because of Crazy Horse and Custer. because of Buffalo Soldiers and Buffalo Bill Cody, because of Marshall Dillon and Wild Bill Hickok. That view of the American West has overwhelmingly been defined from a male lens. And what I love about this book is we see a whole different view of the American West through the eyes of a woman, and not just any woman, but an Omaha Indian woman, and not just any Omaha Indian woman, but a remarkable Omaha Indian woman. So we see a 24-year-old girl getting up at 5 a.m., walking 50 yards to the barn, hitching up her two favorite chocolate mares, Pam and Pudge, to a buggy. It's 24 below zero.
And we'll have to continue that story in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. I'm talking with Joe Sterita. He's the author of A Warrior of the People, How Susan LaFlesh Overcame Racial and Gender Equality to Become America's First Indian Doctor. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're learning about a remarkable woman, Susan LaFlesh, who became the first Native American doctor, male or female, in U.S. history in 1889. She was a member of the Omaha tribe. She is the subject of the new book, A Warrior of the People, written by Joe Sterita. And he's going to be visiting Iowa State University on Monday, April 10th. He'll be speaking at 7 p.m. in Curtis Hall. The lecture is open to the public. And Joe, before the break, we were focusing on the education of Susan LaFlesh. Becoming a doctor in and of itself was incredibly remarkable. But now she graduates from medical school at the top of her class, and the opportunities for women doctors at that time were very limited. But she clearly has one goal in mind. She wants to go back home. She wants to be a doctor for her people. How does she accomplish that?
Every time she weakened, every time she didn't know if she could pull it off, every time that she was a little unsure of whether or not she could endure, she always had that almost metaphorical shining light guiding her back to her homeland. This is what I was put on earth to do. This is why I need to stay here and study. And one day I will graduate and I will be able to realize my dream. So on March 14th, 1889, she walks across the stage in Philadelphia. She is the valedictorian of her class, not the daughter of all the Wanamakers and the movers and shakers on the East Coast, but this Omaha Indian girl from the Great Plains graduates number one in her class. So what I was saying, what I love about this story is that the view of the American West gets totally flipped 180 degrees. This isn't Custer standing on a hill fighting off swarms of Lakota and Northern Cheyenne and Arapaho. This isn't Buffalo Bill Cody recreating and restaging a bygone era for crowds in Paris and London. This isn't Marshall Dillon walking down Main Street, pulling his gun out and shooting the bad guys. This is an Omaha Indian girl freshly minted as the first American Indian doctor in the United States' 113-year history, and now she's back on the Omaha reservation, and it's 5 o'clock in the morning, and it's 24 below zero, and she's all alone in a buggy with her two chocolate mares and a buffalo robe slung across her shoulder. She is 24 and has inherited instantly, just like that, 1,244 patients scattered across 1,350 square miles of this vast reservation covered in 18 inches of snow, completely dark, before Google Maps. And she had gotten some vague directions from a relative that if she went 3 miles north on Omaha Creek and then turned west a half a mile, she should start looking for a little whiff of smoke in this one-room log cabin, because inside there was a 14-year-old girl curled up in a fetal position dying of tuberculosis on a dirt floor, and Susan has to save her. And Susan is cold, and it's pitch dark, and she does this every day, often not getting home until after 10 o'clock at night. And what you see in this portrait of the American West, it's so much more intimate. It's so much more human. Susan says in her journal, in her diaries, that there are times when it's 20 below and it's 5 o'clock in the morning and she's all alone in this vast reservation, that she starts to panic and she starts to feel the prairie closing in on her. And she wonders and is haunted by, am I going to die alone? Am I going to die without ever having a husband? Am I going to die without ever having children and a family? And sometimes it's so powerful, this sense of fear of being all alone, it's overwhelming. And you don't see that in biographies of Crazy Horse or Custer. You see her desperately in love when she's at Hampton, when she's at medical school, with whom she describes as the handsomest Indian I ever saw, in long letters back home to her sister Rosalie and her sister Marguerite. But she can't fall in love with him, even though she's desperately in love with him. He comes over to her dorm in Hampton, Virginia, and plays the flute every morning. She is dreaming of him. He's dreaming of her. But the Connecticut Indian Association puts down the law and says, we will not pay for your medical school if you don't break it off with this guy, this Yankton Dakota boy named T.I. So she is absolutely having her heart ripped out from her. She writes 3.5-page letters to Rosalie, her sister, describing the horrible breakup and how much it hurts, but she has to do it for the good of her people. So you get this really, really personal, intimate portrait of what it's like to be a Omaha Indian woman in the closing years of the 19th century and the opening years of the 20th century, and how valiantly she fights and fights and fights to keep alcohol off the reservation, to keep screen doors on all of the homes to keep out the flies, spreading kerosene in the corners to kill the flies, banning the communal drinking cup, which is now spreading tuberculosis and diphtheria and influenza to a people who have no resistance against any of this. She becomes a devout Christian. She sings in church choir. She orchestrates burials. She translates legal documents. She is interviewed by all kinds of cultural scholars. I mean, if you just read her diary, after 3 days of looking at what she does in the course of a typical day, you just want to close it and go out for a walk because you're overwhelmed. You can't believe that anybody could do this for 3 days, let alone for 5 years.
Well, and she works herself nearly to death. I mean,
absolutely,
her health suffers because of this.
Absolutely. All those years riding in sub-zero weather, in a howling wind, across frozen terrain with no headgear, it takes her toll. You will look at her diary, and you will see the number of times that the diary entry for that day ends. It's after midnight, went to bed supperless, too tired to eat. So she's working 18 and 20 hours a day, and she starts a library on the Omaha Reservation. I mean, she's like this one-woman wrecking ball who just is nonstop, and she hosts quilting circles in the evening. She goes on all of these house calls, and finally she's so exhausted from spending 14 hours across this vast reservation and only seeing maybe 4 people that she has a dream, and her dream is to one day build a hospital in Walt Hill in the middle of the reservation, where all the patients who need medical help will be there, and she can walk out the front door, turn right, go 5 blocks north, and bang, she's at the hospital, not in a buggy, not in 5 a.m. Time, not in 20 below weather. And so she starts fundraising. And in 1914, this Omaha Indian doctor realizes her dream when there is a modern hospital built on a hill overlooking her home in the Omaha Reservation that she has built without a single dollar of tax money. She has raised all $9,000 by herself, gotten all the money by herself, and had this modern hospital built 5 blocks from her home without any tax money. That was a pretty remarkable achievement then, and it would be a pretty remarkable achievement now.
She also decides that even though there's all this pressure on her to be almost superhuman and to forego love and family and all of that, she decides that she wants to have that as part of her life, too. And I was just heartbroken by when she falls in love again and decides to marry this man, the lack of support that she received from family and from these sponsors out east, these women saying, well, no one is good enough for you. You can't marry this man because he'll ruin you.
Right, right. Yeah, and I mean, how arrogant and how ignorant of
and
somebody,
of
somebody 1,500 miles away to impose their idea of what life is all about on somebody who, I mean, to be an Omaha Indian woman, it was unthinkable that you wouldn't be a mother. I mean, that was an enormous part of your identity, as it is in non-Indian cultures. So for her to sacrifice all of these years and all of these hours riding in this open buggy and all of the attention that she gave everybody else on the reservation, she made a decision that, okay, I am now going to do what's best for me, not what's best for the Connecticut Indian Association or any of my white female sponsors 1,500 miles away. I'm going to do what is best for Susan LaFleche. And she does marry, and she does have a husband, and she does have two small boys that she is absolutely devoted to. And what's unique, again, about this view of the American West is here's this American Indian woman in the waning years of the 19th century, the opening years of the 20th century, and she has to figure out how to balance family and career. And there's no role models for her to fall back on. Some morning she has to bundle up little Pierre in buffalo robes, put him in the carriage, and go off to treat somebody with influenza. Some days her husband, Henry, is a stay-at-home father. He takes care of the two boys and lets his wife go off. But she is tormented by, if I stay home, I'm going to feel guilty because I'm not taking care of my patients. And if I go out and take care of my patients, I'm going to feel guilty because I've left my two small sons at home with my husband. Now, there aren't that many women who she can turn to and say, can you give me some advice on how you pull this off? How do you balance family and career? I'm struggling with that. She looks around and asks for somebody to advise her on that, and there's nobody there because there's nobody else in her shoes. And that's another kind of remarkable and interesting aspect of seeing the American West refracted through the lens of an Omaha Indian woman as opposed to George Custer or Crazy Horse.
Now, at the same time, she is accomplishing so much and caring for her children, and she survives her husband's death. She is caring for her mother and is stretched so thin. She has these periods I mentioned. She would work herself to the point of sickness, and then and then people would actually think she was going to die, and she would come back from the brink. But learn later on, and she learns much later on, that this isn't just illness. This isn't just a stress-induced collapse, but she has bone cancer.
Right. And how can you make up what happened towards the end of her life? How can you make up that her sister, her beloved sister Marguerite, who she went to Elizabeth, New Jersey, who she went to Hampton with, who lived right across the street from her, felt so bad and so hopeless and so panicked when the bone cancer started to spread deeper and deeper that they write a letter to the only woman who has ever won two Nobel Prizes in history. They write a letter to Marie Curie, who is experimenting with a lot of different kinds of radiation treatments for cancer at the very time that Susan is starting to go downhill from cancer. And so one morning there arrives a box in Walled Hill, Nebraska, and inside the box is a steel-lined other box. And inside the steel-lined box is a radium pellet with instructions to very specifically drop this into a certain way and a certain part of her ear canal. And it's the best I can do for you. It's the best I can hope for. You have nothing to lose if she's this sick, and this is what I recommend. And so they call the doctor, and the doctor comes over, and he bungles the insertion of the radium pellet into her ear. And very few hours after that, Susan LaFleche dies a very agonizing death in her home.
So we have this amazing insight into a remarkable woman. She left behind so much, and I know that you also gathered oral tradition stories from her surviving relatives as well. But she was a member of this group of people that was so persecuted and so discriminated against, and she herself would ask for support from the government. It would be offered, then it would be denied. She went through all of these broken promises herself in her lifetime. What do you think her legacy is? She worked so hard for her people. She left us her stories. What lived on?
Yeah, well, okay, two comments on that. Number one, yes, she was she had a lot of roadblocks put in front of her, but kind of the majesty and the magic and the beauty of Susan's narrative arc is that she never let any of those knock her down and keep her down. She just kept going. She was going to become a doctor no matter what. She was going to come home and take care of her people no matter what, and that's what she did. And I believe this book is roughly 95,000 words. If you poured all 95,000 words into a strainer and you let 94,985 of those words slip out the bottom, so you were left with 15 words that defined the essence of this story, I would say that Susan LaFleche did not believe that the purpose of life was to try and avoid pain and suffering, because that was impossible. Susan LaFleche, in every level of her DNA, believed that the purpose of life was to find a purpose and then to find the courage to live out that purpose. And that's what she did every day of her life.
And as I mentioned, you collected oral stories of her from her family. Does her legend live on among the Omaha people?
It's gaining much more traction now than it ever has before. I have a scholarship fund that I established 3 years ago for Native American high school graduates. It goes to three students, $1,500 scholarship a year. And I just spent the weekend, because the due date for this year was April 1st, and I spent the weekend reading through all of the scholarships, and probably six of them come from the Omaha Reservation. Five of those six are from girls, 18, 17-year-old girls on the Omaha Indian Reservation. And all of the girls, all five of the girls who have applied for this scholarship, all five of them, in their 500-word essay on what does it mean to you to be a Native American, all five of the Omaha Indian girls mentioned that Susan LaFleche was a powerful role model and inspiration in their life. And I'm guessing if you would have done this 10 years ago, that wouldn't have been the case. And I am predicting that when I read these next year and 2 years and 5 years from now, more and more people will know about her, because they're using her story more effectively in the schools on the Omaha Reservation. There's a movie that was done, a documentary that was aired nationally on PBS in November that elevated her profile, and I hope that this book does the same thing. We need to know about Susan LaFleche. What's not to like?
Joe, thank you so much for talking with me today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Joe Sterita, he is the author most recently of A Warrior of the People, How Susan LaFleche Overcame Racial and Gender Inequality to Become America's First Indian Doctor. This is Talk of Iowa.